From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In the age of 140 characters or less, fear has been growing among journalists and many readers that long-form storytelling may be lost. People typically sort long-form journalism into two categories. There's investigative or watchdog reporting, and then there's the kind we're going to talk about now, richly textured nonfiction narratives that delve deeply into the human experience and may have nothing to do with the day's headlines. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, far from being lost, these long-form stories are starting to crop up in new and sometimes surprising places.
As a youngster, Jackie Bonaschinsky always knew where to turn for a good read.
Magazines, of course, have always been a home for that, especially the big-name magazines, Esquire. Sports Illustrated, a lot of the stuff I learned when I was younger and trying to figure this out was by reading Sports Illustrated, but I would be reading not about a sport, but about the people in the sport. Playboy did this stuff back in the day. Ooh.
Bonaschinsky became a newspaper reporter and editor herself, a Pulitzer winner. She says in their heyday, the nation's great newspapers published such work routinely, and not just at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
The Philadelphia Inquirer, in my mind, was the gold standard. It was the one we looked to. The Miami Herald, the Detroit Free Press had some amazing writers.
But it's expensive to tie up reporters on intensive projects, and newspaper budgets are tight. Bonaschinsky is now a professor at the University of Missouri Journalism School.
When you have 30, 40, 50, 60% fewer reporters, and when the reporters that you have left are so busy chasing infobits online, you're not going to have as much time for this kind of work.
Prestige magazines are thinner than they used to be, yet readers are stumbling across some intense reads in unexpected spots. On SB Nation, readers can find passionate postings, as well as analyses of a lot of those info bits when it comes to professional and collegiate sports. It is a network of more than 300 fan-driven blogs. Glenn Stout describes SB Nation as
a place that, quite frankly, a little over 6 months ago, did not really exist as a place for work of that quality.
Late last year, SB Nation hired Stout to commission and edit long-form pieces for the site. For more than two decades, he has been the series editor of the annual book Best American Sports Writing. Now, SB Nation posts 2 to 4 such deep dives a week, often multimedia efforts, including a look at how a pair of brothers from Seattle built an empire based on posters of sports stars.
They wanted to be part of the picture. It became a thing where I want a Costakis Brothers poster made of me.
And the suicide of a former University of Maryland men's basketball player who made one of the most famous shots in the school's history.
Yes, it's good! It's good!
I want stories that once I read them once, I want to read them a second time.
Again, Glenn Stout.
Readers are hungry for really good work. And more, they are more and more likely to go looking for that work online, for something they can read on their tablet or read on their phone.
SB Nation is owned by Vox Media, which also created The Verge, a site covering digital culture, and Polygon, a gamer review and news site. Jim Bankoff is CEO of Vox, and he hired Stout.
We looked around the web, and we realized that there was a race to the bottom, if you will, with a lot of content.
Bankoff says many online aggregators focus on lists and photo galleries to the exclusion of reported pieces.
Part of why web content became shorter and less substantive was that publishers believed in order to have a successful digital business model, they had to produce things as quickly and as cheaply as possible.
Bankoff says he decided to dart in the opposite direction at SB Nation.
What we found at Vox is that long-form stories are incredibly attractive to advertisers. People are spending a lot of time with them. I think on average it's about 17 minutes in our case, but it's sometimes much longer than that. And with such a glut and such a sea of stuff on the web that is often not substantive, often is quick listicles or even worse, we find that advertisers are flocking to quality and trying to get it where they can.
Vox is not the only new media publisher betting long. The viral website BuzzFeed, which posts adorable animal and baby pictures by the cartload, also publishes many lengthy and original political pieces. In one, the reporter McKay Coppins wrote about his experience as a Mormon, covering the nation's first Mormon major party presidential nominee. Reuters and Bloomberg News have beefed up their enterprise reporting and hired many experienced newspaper reporters. Some not-for-profit news sites have surfaced as well. None of this activity fully replaces the watchdog reporting that was lost at state capitals and city halls throughout the country due to the hollowing out of major metropolitan newspapers. But Jackie Bonaschinsky sees some hope for the textured reporting and deep dives to which she has dedicated her career.
When I go online, there's all of these little pockets of passion that have sprung up that are creating homes for it that never used to exist, or at least were harder to find.
SB Nation's Glenn Stout says he doesn't care whether his boss's motivation is commercial or journalistic. All he cares about, Stout says, is their willingness to let him publish the kind of writing he thinks is worth reading. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
A top executive at News Corporation dropped a bombshell this week when he said the company may end Fox's over-the-air broadcasts and go strictly to cable. It's a retaliation move after a victory in court by a startup company that streams broadcast channels online. NPR's Dan Bobkoff tells us why this has the TV networks worried.
The most feared man in television right now is soft-spoken and rather techy.
So I have just launched the Aereo application.
Chet Kanogia is showing me Aereo, the service he launched about a year ago. It's only in the New York City area right now. For a monthly fee, Aereo takes broadcast TV signals and streams them over the internet. With a tap on his iPad, the local Fox station pops up on the screen.
Welcome back. That was Sheila.
And this is what has networks like Fox up in arms. For $8 a month, Aereo will provide a high-definition feed of the basic over-the-air channels, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the like. If you're tech-savvy, you can even watch it on your TV. Kanogia says he saw demand for a cable alternative.
Most people watch 7 or 8 channels, even though they had 500 channels, and about a third of the households effectively just watch network television.
The problem, the stations say, is that they don't get a penny of Aereo's monthly fees.
The fear is that if Aereo is allowed to continue, really the new economic foundation of the broadcast business is threatened.
Robin Flynn is a senior analyst at SNL Kagan, which researches the media business. That new economic foundation is something called a retransmission fee. Until a few years ago, cable companies didn't pay anything to deliver you basic broadcast channels. That changed about 5 years ago. Flynn says as part of customers' cable bills, they now pay about $1 a month for each station. That's turned into a big source of revenue for local affiliates, totaling $2.3 billion last year, on top of all the money stations get from advertising.
The networks have really started to depend on the dual revenue stream to enable them to pay for programming, including sports programming and scripted dramas.
Of course, if you had rabbit ears on your TV, you wouldn't pay anything for the stations either. And that's the loophole Aereo thinks it's found. Aereo actually assigns subscribers their own dime-sized antennas in its data center. Each one sends a signal over the internet to just one user. So when the networks say Aereo should be paying them fees just like the cable companies do, Kanogia says his service is no different than having an antenna at home.
Because we're not a cable company. We had an antenna technology, and ever since broadcasting started, no antenna manufacturer, no television manufacturer has been required to pay any kind of a transmission fee.
So far, an appeals court agrees with him. A consortium of networks tried to block Aereo, accusing the company of profiting off the copyrighted shows they spend millions to produce and air. But Aereo prevailed in the case. It was after that ruling that News Corporation President Chase Carey called Aereo a pirate and threatened to take Fox off the airwaves in retaliation. Soon, Univision said the same. Most think this is saber-rattling, but media lawyer Matt Del Nero says there's some precedent for the station's argument. He was not involved in the Aereo case, though he does work with some of the networks that filed suit. He says years ago, cable companies made similar arguments to the ones Aereo makes now.
They said, we're simply delivering broadcast signals that someone could get just as easily over the air. And Congress looked at that and said, well, wait a minute, but you're obviously delivering some value with that content because subscribers are willing to pay you monthly fees for that.
It was then that over-the-air stations gained the right to charge for their channels. If Aereo continues to prevail in court, Del Nero says cable companies could copy its model and free themselves from the fees. And after another court ruled against a similar service in California, all this may ultimately end up in the Supreme Court. Dan Bobkoff, NPR News, New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court examines a question for the 21st century, whether human genes may be patented.
The case involves a Utah company, Myriad Genetics. It isolated two genes that have mutations leading to breast and ovarian cancer.
Myriad patented that discovery, giving it a monopoly for 20 years on the use of the genes for research, diagnostics, and treatment.
Researchers, medical groups, and patients challenged this move, asking if you can really patent some of a genetic code to life.
Now, the commercial implications here are huge, so the story is today's business bottom line. Here's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
There is no way to overstate the importance of this case to the future of science and medicine. In the view of Myriad and its supporters in the biotech and pharmaceutical industries, patents are the keys to making discoveries possible. Their opponents, including leading medical groups and Nobel Prize-winning scientists, contend that Myriad's patent improperly puts a lock on research and diagnostics. The U.S. patent system was authorized in the Constitution to give temporary economic incentives to inventors in order to advance science. The general rules have been established in statutes and Supreme Court precedent for over 150 years. You can't patent a product of nature or a law of nature. It doesn't matter that the task has been difficult or costly. Nature is immune to patents. So even though it may have taken Einstein a long time to figure out that E equals mc squared, he couldn't have patented that law of nature. Until relatively recently, much of the medical profession disdained patents, except to ensure quality. Here, for example, is Dr. Jonas Salk in 1955 responding to a question on CBS about whether he had patented his revolutionary polio vaccine.
There is no patent. This is... Could you patent the sun?
In today's case, Myriad Genetics contends that the genes it isolated are not like the sun. CEO Mark Capone notes that the 20,000 genes in the human body exist in a 6-foot-long molecule that's coiled and compacted and stuffed into each cell.
What Myriad was able to do is sort through all those 20,000 genes and find the two that were highly linked to hereditary breast and ovarian cancer.
It is as though a single grain of sand was compared to the Empire State Building's height.
That's Gregory Castanis, Myriad's lawyer. He'll tell the justices that isolating the genes known as BRCA, or BRCA1 and 2 genes, justifies a patent because
it is the final step in an extraordinarily complicated set of inventive actions that led to the creation of this molecule, which had never been available to the world before.
Not so, says the ACLU's Christopher Hansen, representing researchers and others challenging the patent. Human genes, he contends, are products of nature. They're parts of the body.
All Myriad does is take a part of the body out of the body. It is no different than taking a kidney out of the body. Just because you're the person who takes the kidney out of the body doesn't entitle you to a patent on kidneys.
Myriad's lawyer, however, contends that by isolating the gene and snipping it out of the other DNA material, Myriad has created a new and patentable thing.
It is no different than allowing a baseball bat or a cast iron fence to be patented as a new invention. And just because those originated in a tree or originated in a rock where the iron had to be removed from it, that doesn't make those human inventions any less patent eligible.
NYU law professor Rochelle Dreyfus, a nationally known patent expert who's not associated with either side in this case, puts the question before the court this way.
We do know Myriad did a lot of work, but is the thing that's isolated significantly different from the way that it was when it was in nature?
Lawyer Hansen, representing the patent challengers, contends that Myriad is merely following nature's instructions about where to snip out the gene.
The structure of the gene, where the gene starts, where the gene ends, all of those are decisions that nature made. Myriad just uncovered the fact that nature had made those decisions.
What's more, he argues, by patenting the BRCA1 and 2 genes, Myriad has hampered research by scientists outside the company. The company denies that, contending that 18,000 scientists have published 10,000 papers on the genes. Some researchers concede that Myriad has not invoked its right to block their research, but they're galled by the fact that the information they turn up in clinical trials cannot be shared with patients. And patients are outraged that they can't get a second opinion on their own genes. They cite, for example, the case of Kathleen Maxian, whose sister was tested by Myriad for the BRCA genes after she had breast cancer at an early age. Based on the negative results that came back, All of the women in the family thought they were not at a heightened risk of breast or ovarian cancer. 2 years later, however, Kathleen was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and a different and supplemental test Myriad then offered showed the family did have the BRCA gene. Genetic counselor Ellen Matloff says that scientists learned in the late 1990s and early 2000s that the Myriad test was missing mutations in some families.
I contacted Myriad Genetics and asked them if we could offer a test for our patients who tested negative, but in whom we really suspected we were missing something, and we were told, absolutely not, it's a patent violation.
Another bone of contention over the patent is the charge for the test. Myriad charges $3,000 for a test experts say costs only $200. Myriad CEO Capone says the company is simply trying to recoup the tens of millions of dollars it invested in these two genes alone. Chris Hansen has a tart reply for that.
A patent isn't a reward for effort. A patent is a reward for invention. And Myriad didn't invent anything.
Each side in this case sees the future of science threatened. Those challenging Myriad see gene patenting as an attempt to monopolize and block future exploration in the new universe of genetics and how it applies to finding new treatments for disease. Myriad and its supporters, however, see patents as the key to exploration. Myriad CEO Capone.
We believe we are on the cusp of a revolution of how we treat our patients in this country by translating personalized medicine into the clinic. But without the incentives offered by a strong and stable intellectual property system, we do not believe we will be able to translate these incredible discoveries that we are about to make into clinical care for patients.
Myriad lawyer Greg Cassanius is a little more down to earth.
On some level, it is about money because medicine doesn't happen for free. If you look at the enormous amount of investment, and not everything works that you invest in, the patent system is critical to medical care.
So how do other countries handle this dilemma? Most do grant patents on genes, but they also have exceptions to the patent, allowing researchers to use the genes freely and allowing anyone who can to develop diagnostic tests. That, however, would require an act of Congress. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Coming up in the next hour, we check in with The Atlantic's James Fallows and remember the prima ballerina from the plains of Oklahoma, Maria Tallchief, and also the latest copyright concerns from writer and Authors Guild president Scott Turow. But first, let's start today with a scene from Batman, The Dark Knight. In this scene, Batman stands in front of a row of blinking video monitors looking for the Joker.
You've turned every cell phone in Gotham into a microphone.
And a high-frequency generator receiver.
You took my sonar concept and applied it to every phone in the city. With half the city feeding you sonar, you can image all of Gotham. This is wrong.
Funny how film about technology that seemed so impossible just a few years ago seems ever more prescient. But in a world of big data, what you can track seems infinite. That's our cover story today, Big Data, the aggregation of our digital data trail. Who collects it, how they use it, and where we're going with it. Gary Marcus writes for the New Yorker's tech blog. He says collating big data is like gathering digital dust.
Big data, one way to think about it is it's a very valuable tool, but it's rarely the whole solution by itself.
Marcus tells us about Watson. That was the supercomputer IBM designed to compete on Jeopardy on TV a couple of years ago. Alex Trebek even introduced Watson.
Developed and programmed especially for this moment, making its first appearance on our national television program. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson.
Part of the way it did so well is they had a massive database, namely Wikipedia, built into it. And they were able to trawl that and also other aspects of the web in order to make good guesses.
Watson.
Who is Jude?
Yes. Watson.
Who is Michael Phelps?
Yes. Watson.
What is Event Horizon?
Yes.
Watson literary appeared to understand Trebek as he asked the questions. He competed against the two top Jeopardy champions, and Watson won. But big data doesn't function like a human brain.
There are also other things like classic artificial intelligence techniques, like temporal reasoning, trying to figure out, well, was this person alive before this other person?
Hmm.
Big data might get confused if you just used it by itself. It might say, well, these two things are very correlated, but it doesn't say, well, which one happened before which other one.
We've always had access to digital information, of course, ever since it was invented. But to understand how much there is now and how fast things are changing, we turn to Chris Barnett. He teaches computing at Nottingham University in England and runs a site called ExplainingComputers.com.
We've got more powerful processors, the cost of memory gets less, the cost of storage gets less, and also a lot more data is being created, everything from social media sites to people doing buying things online with e-commerce to simulations going on in companies and medical facilities. Everyone's creating more and more information.
And we're processing this data differently, using it almost narratively to make patterns and predictions.
Hospitals get lots and lots of information from their patients, and they don't just capture information on them in terms of who they are and their details, but they, for example, might put a camera inside someone during an operation and look at that data and probably just throw it away because they wouldn't see any value in that data after the operation. In a big data world, you'd say, well, if you can capture all the information from all the cameras put into every patient in the world in a year, you could look at all that data with a piece of artificial intelligence and start to predict things about the actual health of the population.
And the faster this goes, the more clients want it. Svetlana Sikular is a director at Gartner, a data research firm. She helps her business clients figure out what they can do with all that wealth of information.
Data is becoming pervasive. It's getting new qualities. For example, maps are the data, or text or voice or video, or geolocation of where you are. We can know everything about it.
Big data's not just what happens when marketing companies target their audience, you know, like those ads that pop up on a search engine. You search for one pair of shoes, you get shoe ads for weeks. It's also diagnostic. Like Chris Barnett in England, Svetlana Sikular sees big data making advances in medicine.
Medical records are being digitized by analyzing massive amounts of text records of those doctors' notes which were sitting somewhere in folders on the shelves. We can find out something which is really astonishing. We can find from doctors' notes that it's enough to look for some particular vein on the neck, and you will be able to predict that that's the best indicator of a disease.
Then there are the big data skeptics. Big data doesn't think. It evaluates, aggregates, and predicts. But reasoning, you could say there's a breakdown between cause and effect. Kate Crawford, a researcher from Microsoft and a visiting professor at MIT, gives an example from Boston. The city wanted data to fix its potholes, so it developed a smartphone app called Street Bump.
It passively collects GPS data and accelerometer data so that it can report when you drive over potholes.
Cool, right? Instead of having to actively seek out the potholes, the city could use people's phones to figure out when the car suddenly thumped over a rough spot. Except for one thing. The app only captured data in more affluent neighborhoods.
And indeed, this maps very closely around how rich a particular neighborhood is and what the ages of the people who live in that neighborhood.
Skewed data that collates only from better-off people might be missing a lot more than potholes. The ethics get tricky quickly. Boston's still working to fix both the app and the potholes. But Crawford warns that this kind of situation might happen more often as we look to big data for policy solutions. Steve Lohr has been writing about big data and privacy at the New York Times, where he's a reporter. Remember our Dark Knight example from Gotham? Or we could just as easily have turned to Orwell, because technology is allowing us to track movements around the web and the real world. Lohr isn't sure that all that Big Brother information needs to be tracked, or should be. He quotes Einstein.
Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. And that's the tension here.
Not everything that can be counted counts. But the risk, it seems to me, is that there is a massive invasion of privacy risk. And this is something you've written a lot about.
Look, my concern, for instance, in tracking all your online behavior and aggregating it and making assumptions about you is not that these algorithms are so clever and they know everything. It's that they're so stupid. The real danger for most of us is discrimination by statistical inference.
because it attributes a causality that might not be there.
Exactly. Right. And you know, if you're a simple person, maybe the algorithms sort of work. But if you have a complex set of motivations, you know, you search for deep fat fryers, right? And it may be because you're in a cooking school and that was an assignment, or you're going to buy this for a friend, right? It correlates to unhealthy behavior. It's not just online. I think the place people really give up their privacy and don't realize it is putting everything on a credit card. That's the gold standard. It's got everything on you. And it's all being correlated and put together by these data brokers who track online behavior as well as, you know, your credit card transactions. And so, you know, what happens is your world will be shaped by what your transactions are. And so, you know, put the health club membership on the credit card, but your visits to the liquor store should be in cash. Because those things will follow you in ways you don't know now.
You write that the World Economic Forum issued a report last month that recommended ways in which privacy concerns could be addressed. And they drew from an example of the 1970 Fair Credit Reporting Law. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, this was the earlier round of privacy concerns related to computers. And this goes back to when the world started moving to mainframe computers. And so large corporations and government agencies had increasingly put personal information about your transactions. To some degree, they started putting IRS tax returns on computers. And that was a real wave of concern. And the Fair Credit Reporting Act was a limitation on what you could collect and how you could use it. It could be used, you know, somewhat for hiring and for loan evaluation. But other than that, you couldn't use it carte blanche. And the people who are in the privacy community these days kind of look back at that as, you know, small beer by comparison to
what's
now.
Available
but
now.
People were much more sensitive to it back then. You know, these days you kind of give up a little bit more and a little bit more, and there's advantages. There's advantages to using all these things. The Federal Trade Commission is investigating and has taken some actions, particularly on children and privacy, but also looking at these sort of data brokers in between. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones that facilitate the black box. And the real concern is that the data is used, so that the things that you see in the world and the opportunities you're given will be determined by an algorithmic black box that you don't have any control over and may be wrong about you. And the way regulation is now looking at it, and the investigation that the Federal Trade Commission is doing is pushing for greater transparency. So, and this World Economic Forum report that talks about there should be an audit trail to your data in a way that there isn't now.
So if I'm an individual and I am leaving a data dust trail that is just so extensive, it's difficult to know where you would begin to try to rein some of that in a practical way. How do you protect yourself? Are there any kind of steps you'd take to limit what is known about your transactions?
You know, I'm a participant. I don't really have a good answer, Jackie. Be careful of your online behavior. I mean, it has consequences. It's the opposite of that old New Yorker cartoon where, you know, on the internet, nobody knows your dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They know you.
Steve Lohr, he writes about technology for the New York Times. If we're all just ashes to ashes and dust to dust, big data can keep track at a molecular level. Whether that's a comfort to you or a concern, knowledge is generally power. The question is, for whom? Last spring, the U.S. government invested over $200 million in big data. Coming up, think you know what a T-Rex sounds like? You've got Gary Rydstrom to thank for that. The sound designer for Jurassic Park, up soon on Weekends on All Things Considered. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Advertisers want to hear what you have to say. As NPR's Steve Henn reports, Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley are about to roll out new kinds of ads you can actually converse with. Marketers are hoping to leverage the power of voice and the kinds of technologies that power Apple's Siri to start selling us all sorts of things.
Imagine for a second what it would be like if you could talk to your radio and your radio would actually listen. To get an idea of what that might be like, last week I downloaded an app called Talk to Esquire. It's from the magazine, and when I opened it, the app asked me a question.
What's your favorite type of liquor? Vodka? Whiskey,
okay,
rum,
so that's a little forward, but it's Esquire, so...
Actually, I'm more of a beer drinker.
Well, like they say, all that beer and no whiskey, I think you're making a mistake.
Before I knew it, I found myself engrossed in a chat about booze. I was talking to recordings of a real person, Esquire's David Wondrich, the drinks columnist. He, or I guess really the app, was listening to what I said, and it was answering me back.
I think I'd like something with a flowery umbrella.
Good to hear. I'd like to mix you a classic cocktail.
And this went on for more than 4 minutes. Eventually, my cyber David Wondrich showed me how to mix a Mezcal Old Fashioned.
Stir that.
Professor Clifford Nass at Stanford says this kind of synthetic conversation is possible because of advances in voice and language recognition.
It definitely has gotten much better.
It's no longer just a party trick, but it still has limits.
It's still not super accurate, nowhere near the accuracy of even a two-year-old child.
Nass says an app like Esquire's can only work well when it tightly limits what the conversation is about. Without context, apps like these are lost. Still, many marketers see an opportunity. Some of the biggest technology companies in the country, from Facebook and Google to Microsoft and Amazon, are trying to figure out how to best monetize mobile advertising.
Banner ads, mobile banner ads, just have not been super successful.
Mike McSherry is a vice president at Nuance, a company that specializes in voice recognition technology.
Voice is providing this window to the world of information, and it can be far faster than typing or navigating small screens, which has been typically the challenge of small mobile devices to date.
eMarketer, the digital forecasting company, estimates mobile ads could become a $37 billion business in the next few years. And Nuance wants a piece of that. This month, it released a mobile ad platform that will let advertisers create ads we can talk to. I played one of their demos called Valentine's Doghouse for Clifford Nass.
Who are you in trouble with?
My wife.
And how mad is she?
Folks at Nuance say ads like these could work on digital radio stations or launch after a click. And even though Professor Nass was sitting at his desk with a lollipop in his mouth, mumbling, this ad nailed it. Nass smiled to himself. He chuckled. He engaged with it. Nass says ads like these, at least when they work, have the potential to be incredibly powerful because they interact with us in a profoundly human way.
The human brain is built for speech, so anything that sounds like a voice, our brains just light up and we get an enormous range of social and other responses.
A voice, even a synthetic one, is packed with information our brains are programmed to decode, like gender or age. We can't even help ourselves. So when we talk to a computer and it answers back, Nass says most of us end up acting as if we're dealing with a real person. Social norms kick in seemingly automatically.
Our brains are built to treat these conversations with computer-based voices to an incredible degree, like we were having with actual people, including flattery and flirtation and all the rest. We will see all of those same responses.
NASA's own research has found that people like computers better if those computers flatter them. He found that we're polite to the machines we talk to, and we identify with computerized voices that sound kind of like our own. We're even more likely to buy stuff from them. Advertisers are hoping they'll be able to use all of this. But Nass warns there are big risks in these kinds of interactive ads as well.
When they work well, they're fantastic. When they work poorly, they're really insulting and disturbing.
Nass says if a computer sounds like a person, but then interrupts you and acts like a jerk, real human beings are going to be much more likely to hold a grudge. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
We wanted to find the person who invented the modern replacement for that vintage sound. It turns out it was a team effort, and one member of that team lives in Dallas.
He recalls that the device that put adding machines and even slide rules in the dustbin of history brought other innovations. They changed how we recharged batteries, and they introduced thermal printing using heat-sensitive paper instead of ink.
My name is Jerry Merriman. I spent most of my career at Texas Instruments, where I authored several dozen patents, the most important one being for the first electronic handheld calculator. It was late 1965, and Jack Kilby, my boss, presented the idea of a calculator. He called some people in his office. He says, "We'd like to have some sort of computing device, perhaps to replace the slide rule. It would be nice if it were as small as this little book that I have in my hand. Of course, it would have to operate on batteries. It would have to have some buttons to enter the problem. And it would have to have some neon lights or something like that to give you an answer. You'd have to think of something." Silly me, I thought we were just making a calculator, but we were creating an electronic revolution. It was a very intense effort. It touched many things that I'm reminded of today. We used thermal printing. It was one of the earliest uses of rechargeable batteries. I remember winding the transformer in my garage for the little fist-sized transformer that you plugged in the wall and charged your batteries. So today I see many reminders of that. If I push a button on a cell phone or charge a battery from a wall outlet, or if I just get a thermally printed receipt from a grocery store, it certainly brings back memories of that intense effort in 1965.
That's Jerry Merriman, who helped invent the handheld calculator, along with two colleagues. He was responsible for the keyboard design.